The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is John Federson for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour, I'm going to be reading to you from Indie Week. And a big thank you this week to the entire marching band all the way here from Lake Okoboji, Iowa, and they represent the world-renowned Iowa Navy. And as they march off, we'll now get down to our issue, and that's dated July 1, 2020. And we'll move right into a Voices column, as usual, by Jonathan Weiler this week, a teaching professor at UNC Chapel Hill and Global Studies, called Seeing Red. The lines banks once drew to stifle black prosperity remain easy to find, but hard to erase. Richard Rothstein's The Color of Law, published in 2017, is among the books excavating the roots of racism and white supremacy in the United States that has zoomed to the top of bestseller lists in the wake of the killing of George Floyd. The book's title comes from the long-standing practice of redlining, part of the color-coding scheme lenders used to indicate which neighborhoods were fit for home loans and which weren't. For decades, banks drew red lines around neighborhoods with black homeowners, even if they were well-to-do, signaling that these areas were high risk. As a result, black families could not finance mortgages on the same terms as white. But in a packed and unrelenting 240 pages, Rothstein goes well beyond describing color-coded maps. He shows that, quote, until the last quarter of the 20th century, racially explicit policies of federal, state, and local governments defined where whites and African Americans should live, unquote. And critically, these myriad discriminatory practices ensured that to this day, black people are far more likely than whites to be consigned to substandard housing, with access only to underfunded schools and in impoverished and unsafe communities. In addition, these practices robbed black families of opportunities for the transfer of intergenerational wealth that has sustained so many white families. In 1968, after civil rights era legislation and court rulings largely brought an end to legally enforced segregation, the average wealth of a black family was less than 10% of that of a white family. One critical driver of racist housing policy was the Federal Housing Administration, FHA, created in 1934 during the Great Depression. They backed loans to banks, issuing mortgages, and spurred massive new investments in residential building projects. But until the 1960s, the FHA largely refused to guarantee loans for integrated housing projects. When the FHA drew up guidelines for appraisers in preparation for home sales, for example, it indicated that they should favorably view, quote, appropriate deed restrictions and proper zoning regulations. If that point weren't clear enough, the guidelines stipulated that adverse influences included infiltrations of inharmonious racial or nationality groups. Those guidelines also made clear the necessity of having deed restrictions that prevented the sale of or renting of property to black people. Combined with other policies, government institutions ensured that major public housing projects would be built in segregated neighborhoods and that new middle-class suburbs like Levittown would exclude African Americans. Federal housing policy worked in tandem with other developments to enforce residential segregation. For example, black families who did manage to purchase homes in predominantly white neighborhoods were routinely harassed or terrorized, often forcing these families to live. The typical police response was to stand by and do nothing. When the United States poured billions of dollars into a massively expanded highway system in the 1950s, it used the opportunity to displace many African Americans from their homes, often without compensation. Many new highways ran through the heart of urban neighborhoods, often with the explicit intention of cutting off white from black residential areas. The highway system also created an infrastructure that allowed millions of white Americans to decamp from cities to newly built suburbs from which black families were all but locked out by government policy. By the time federal law shifted fundamentally in the 1960s, the die had already been cast on contemporary residential patterns, school resourcing, and wealth accumulation. This is but a taste of the exhaustive account Rothstein provides of the scope and consequences of government policy to segregate housing in America. But the implications are profound. In his landmark 2014 article, The Case for Reparations, Ta-Nehisi Coates described in the Chicago housing market after World War II, where systematic government policy combined with violent hostility to integrated neighborhoods to require African Americans to buy substandard housing on worse financial terms than whites. Among many consequences, African Americans were robbed of individual, family, and community wealth. As writers like Coates and more recently Nicole Hannah-Jones make the case for reparations, any accounting of how to redress racist residential architecture has to take seriously the massive intergenerational theft that resulted. And there is a graphic in here, but I can basically summarize this, and it involves homemade COVID-19 masks. Homemade masks can be just as effective as medical-grade masks in blocking airborne droplets potentially carrying COVID-19. An April study shows researchers from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign tested the effectiveness of breathability of different homemade mask materials against the three-layer masks used by doctors and nurses. They found while a single-layer T-shirt fabric isn't effective in blocking airborne droplets, the same material is on a par with N95 when used in double and triple layers. And even if you do double or triple up your T-shirt fabric, the breathability remains comparable. Grandma was right. We do need to layer up. And what they indicate is percent effectiveness in blocking droplets. One layer of T-shirt material gives you 43.3% blocking effectiveness. Two layers of the same material, 98.6% blocking. And three layers of T-shirt material, 99.98% effectiveness. And the medical grade mask, 96.3%. So medical grades don't have it quite up to efficiency for droplets as this T-shirt material, doubled or tripled. That's good to know. Now we'll move right over to the good, the bad, and the awful. The good, immigration. On Friday, a California federal judge ordered that all undocumented children in ICE custody for more than 20 days must be released from the Family Detention Center and shelters run by the Office of Refugee Resettlement. There are over 100 children currently in these detention centers and another 500 in the ORR shelters. These often close-quartered confinements give COVID-19 a chance to thrive, especially since there hasn't been comprehensive testing in these centers. U.S. District Judge Dolly G. wrote in her decision that the ICA facilities were, quote, on fire, and that, quote, there is no more time for half measures. The children must be released by July 17. While there's still no word on whether adult family members will be released with their children, the measure is still a step in the right direction. The bad. Glenwood South bars. We know. Everyone is getting antsy in quarantine, especially with phase two still in effect for another 3 weeks. For some bars, this meant throwing caution to the wind. On Friday night, two Raleigh bars, Cornerstone Tavern and Alchemy on Glenwood South, opened in defiance of a judicial order requiring bars to stay closed amid the pandemic, as well as a veto from Governor Cooper on a GOP-backed legislative attempt to reopen them. Both bars were said to be operating as private clubs, according to the NC Bar and Tavern Association, and required masks inside the establishment, but videos on social media have shown that Raleigh bar hoppers aren't the best at following mask mandates and social distancing guidelines. And the awful, the General Assembly. Last night was a busy one for the North Carolina General Assembly, and several of their decisions may haunt the state for years to come. At 3 a.m. Friday morning, the state legislature passed a bill that keeps death investigation records from falling under the Freedom Information Act. The guise is that it makes it easier for the state medical examiner to obtain records of unexpected deaths, including those deaths while in law enforcement custody or prison. Now, these law enforcement records will be kept from the press and the families before they reach the medical examiner's office. If you thought that was disheartening, in a different kind of power play, the General Assembly approved Art Pope, a multimillionaire Republican power broker and Koch Brothers associate, as the newest member of the UNC Board of Governors. While a student at UNC Chapel Hill, he sued a black student movement leader for interrupting KKK leader David Duke during a campus visit. And we move now to the area columnist, Tomasi McDonald from Raleigh is first, Forgotten Monuments. Hundreds of Black Lives Matter protesters in Raleigh celebrated Juneteenth this year by pulling down the statues of two Confederate soldiers on the Capitol grounds. More quietly, just hours before and less than a mile away, a handful of volunteers paid tribute to Forgotten Monuments, the graves of enslaved and free black people at the Raleigh City Cemetery, the city's oldest public burial ground. Clad in bright yellow vests, the volunteers gathered around Ryan Lurch, Raleigh Park's superintendent, who talked about the black residents buried there. Listed on the National Register of Historic Places, the 7.6-acre Raleigh City Cemetery is only one of only two public cemeteries in the state. The other is New Bern, with one entrance at Harrogate and East Street and another on New Bern Avenue. The park is tucked into a residential area in the shadow of downtown. The cemetery contains the remains of the city's earliest settlers and state legislators, alongside the stonemasons from Scotland and England who built the state capital. When the Raleigh City Cemetery's preservation nonprofit was formed in 2006, the acre-and-a-half black section was intact. But badly neglected. Many of the tombstones had been overturned. Some were broken, others marred with graffiti. RCCP partnered with city officials to hire Dean Rudrick, a restoration specialist who had worked all over the country rebuilding slave cabins and restoring grave markers, to rehabilitate the enslaved section, which was in the worst shape. When it was filled in 1871, it was closed, and the city created the Mount Hope Cemetery to house the remains of black citizens. Even though 1,000 black people are buried here, only 60 monuments and grave markers remained when restoration work began. RCCP member Jane Thurman said some had been vandalized while others were removed by family members. When Rudrick started his restoration, he found that some tombstones in the black section had sunk about an inch underground over time. Most of the markers lay flat in the grass after breaking off at the base. Now, Rudrick, who died last year, started working in the enslaved section in 2015, finishing 3 years later. He built new bases for the fallen monuments. He dug up others and found several more, including footstones that contained only the initials of the deceased. Thurman says, "One of the best days in my life was standing in that section, seeing those graves upright. Many of the thin, time-starred concrete and marble tombstones are inscribed with names and dates that are barely legible. Some are nameless. There are several with only the curving tops are visible. In many ways, these modest, weathered markers are analogous to the physical and psychological condition of the people they stand to represent, gouged, chipped, broken remnants that survived against all odds." The black graves in the Raleigh City Cemetery offer a striking contrast to the imposing Confederate monuments that are falling across the national landscape. The markers are a metaphor for what was the majestic big house of the slave owners, in close proximity to the terrible quarters where the enslaved lived, and what is the refurbishing and building of white-owned homes next to creaky, resource-neglected, black-owned dwellings. The global protests that erupted after the killing of George Floyd are about the neglect and desecration of black bodies, which was already laid bare by the pandemic. Shelley M. Winters, one of the volunteers who helped clean branches and brambles from the black graves in Raleigh, echoed that sentiment. "Where are the statues for the people who built the Capitol?" she asks. It was Winters who came up with the idea to clean the tombstones as a somber and reflective means to honor Juneteenth by paying tribute to those who died wanting freedom. "It's not just black history," Winters says. "This is Raleigh history. It's American history, and it should be honored as such. We have no names, no faces for the people who physically built and sustained this city." Winters is the niece of John Winters, who, before he died of Parkinson's disease in 2004, worked as a developer and is largely responsible for Southeast Raleigh becoming a black enclave. He served on the city council and later became one of the first black senators after decades of black voter suppression since the late 1800s. The Winters family descendants were born free. There's a plaque commemorating them on East Street, a stone's throw from the cemetery. Shelley Winters served as chair of Raleigh's Citizens Advisory Councils and the Atlantic CAC before they were disbanded by the city council in February. She wanted to do something to honor the Juneteenth holiday and called Grady Busey, the chair of the city's annual African American Cultural Festival. Busey, Winters says, was unenthusiastic about celebrating the fact that some black captives endured two more years in forced labor camps after President Lincoln proclaimed their freedom. But then Winters, who is now a member of the city's planning commission, had the idea of giving dignity to the enslaved population by cleaning their grave sites. "It was like a light bulb that hit me," Winters said. "Juneteenth is not just a point of freedom, but also to honor those who were enslaved. We figured the best thing to do was paying homage to the slave ancestors," Busey adds. Winters says she first reached out to the residents of Oberlin Village, the formerly all-black community that cleans the graves in its own community cemetery each year. When she found out the residents had not planned a cemetery cleaning for Juneteenth, Busey suggested the city cemetery. A little more than a dozen people showed up. The tombstones of the enslaved, even with faded lettering and dates, told many stories. Enslaved people in Raleigh died young. Of the 30 stone markers where death dates are listed or otherwise known, the average age of death was about 29. That's taking into account Nancy Kennedy, who died in 1858 at age 85, and Jane Dickerson, who passed in 1844 at age 90. It also includes five babies who were one or younger when they died. Thurman says that Caroline Stronach, who died at 29, was either the wife or sister of Columbus Stronach, a stonemason who owned a business across from the cemetery and constructed many of the tombstones at that location. There are tombstones marking the remains of five people who died in their teens. Thomas Weems was 16, so was John Scott. Martha Buffalo, 17. John Johnson, 16, died just days after President Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation. Anne Morgan died at 19, 1 year after emancipation, and little Albert Norwood was 2 when he died in 1857. Harriet Bryan was born in 1799. "Sacred to the memory of Harriet," reads her tombstone, "an honest and faithful domestic servant in the family of John H. Bryan." Chaney Harris was beloved by her children. "The stone erected in memory of our mother, Chaney Harris, who departed this life on June 24, 1832, reads her marker. Apparently, the enslaved mother's children were unsure of when she was born. "She died at an advanced age," her tombstone says. Most prominent among the graves of the enslaved was Cato, C-A-T-O, who had an obituary printed in the Raleigh Minerva newspaper owned by noted citizen William Boylan, who is also buried in the city cemetery. Cato, a printer and bookbinder in Boylan's downtown shop, was enslaved by Boylan's uncle. Cato died in 1811. RCCP member Betsy Shaw discovered his obituary in the Minerva. Thurman says, "It's one of the most remarkable pieces of history. He was very well liked and had a lot of interaction with the public." The tombstone of Anna Julia Haywood Cooper sits almost on the invisible line that separates the enslaved from the free. That's apt. Cooper was born a slave in 1858, and after emancipation, she went on to become the first black American woman to earn a Ph.D. in history from the Sorbonne in Paris. She was a scholar, author, and early feminist, praised by Frederick Douglass, and a peer of W.E.B. Du Bois. For African-American feminists, she is best known for asserting in 1892 that, quote, "Only the black woman can say when and where I enter, in the quiet, undisputed dignity of my womanhood, without violence and without suing or special patronage. Then and there, the whole Negro race enters with me." Thurman says that in this unique moment, these near-forgotten monuments prompt her to reflect on how we're collecting history and what we think of it. She says she only recently learned about that Tulsa race massacre because it wasn't in her school history books. It's time to face how we created a narrative and tell more stories. Death and time are great equalizers. Slave and slaveholder are in the same cemeteries. In a place that holds the remains of the city's founding fathers and state legislators, Juneteenth was an opportunity to acknowledge those whose names will never be known. Winter says, "It was a way to give them the dignity they did not receive in their lifetimes. It's way overdue." Now, statewide news, Sandy Smith Nonini writes, COVID confidential. Analyses of recent spikes of COVID-19 cases in more than a dozen rural counties strongly suggest links to outbreaks at meatpacking plants. Yet North Carolina officials continue to ignore requests from health and worker advocates to enforce safety regulations at plants and disclose information about industry clusters to the public. Such secrecy not only endangers workers at the plants, but also risks further community spread in rural areas. From May 1st to June 11, cases in zip codes near meatpacking plants jumped 600%, or more than twice the 262% rises in cases statewide, the News and Observer reported. In mid-May, North Carolina led the nation for numbers of plant outbreaks, according to the Food and Environment Reporting Network. As of June 26, at least 2,772 meatpacking workers had tested positive for the virus in outbreaks at 28 plants, according to a spokesperson for the NC Department of Health and Human Services, DHHS. But health officials will not report the locations of such clusters. The most notable surge of cases at plants was in April and May. Since then, plants have voluntarily cooperated with health officials, but most will not reveal data to the public. They are effectively saying to the community, don't worry, trust us. State health officials say they lack regulatory authority over the industry and do not report plant outbreaks for fear of losing plant managers' cooperation. I did an interview study of Latino workers in meatpacking in the early 2000s, which prompted me to drill down into the COVID-19 data. I examined the rise in infection rates in key rural counties for the 2 weeks ending in June 25, new cases adjusted for population, using data from USA Facts, and that data show new or ongoing surges of infections in 14 rural counties, with significant meatpacking operations, including Sampson, Wayne, Bladen, and Duplin counties, the state leaders for pork production, which together employ 19,000 workers. 12 counties with surges are also ranked among the highest in the nation for COVID-19 cases. In addition to the four above, they include Burke, Chatham, Randolph, Johnston, Robeson, Rowan, Sampson, and Union counties. Two others with smaller caseloads but new spikes are Surrey and Wilson counties. While cases are rising across the state due to reopening the economy, such high levels of positive cases are typically found in urban counties. Neither can the high rural numbers be explained by outbreaks in nursing homes or prisons, which, unlike meatpacking, the state DHHS routinely tracks. Also, while elderly, non-Hispanic people make up the bulk of those who have died of the virus, DHHS data show that more than 75% of these positive cases are among people of working age, between 18 and 64. A disproportionate number of those testing positive in these counties are Hispanic, 31 to 73% of cases, which is consistent with the high numbers of Latino workers in meat plants, although Latina farm laborers, who often live in crowded housing, may explain some of these cases. A third of those testing positive near a Mount Air poultry plant with an outbreak in Chatham County this month were Hispanic, yet they make up less than 10% of the state population. Also, more than half the COVID-19 patients admitted to UNC Hospital, and at least two-thirds of those in ICU beds are now Hispanic, which indicates a high burden of coronavirus in the Spanish-speaking population, says David Wall, a UNC infectious disease physician. Outbreaks are also ongoing at Pilgrim's Pride in Lee County and Case Farms in Burke County. An unidentified Latino worker from Case Farms, who spoke on a June 14th group call for workers and advocates, reported that 150 workers had tested positive and three had died, including one Latino, one black, and one white worker. She said in a voice that quavered with anxiety, "I have diabetes, so I'm super scared to go to work, but because of needs I have to go and risk my life." In April and May, significant outbreaks were reported at Tyson Foods poultry plant in Wilkes County, the Butterball turkey plant in Duplin, the largest Smithfield pork plant in Bladen County, and several smaller plants. In late May, a zip code survey by North Carolina Health News found positive tests for COVID-19 were unusually high in the area of Mount Air plant, 414 cases, a smaller Smithfield plant in Clinton, 254, and the Butterball plant, 204 cases. Many workers commute to plants from other areas. Now, this methodology, while inexact, suggests the magnitude of the problem. Nationwide, more than 24,000 COVID-19 cases are tied to meatpacking, resulting in 87 worker deaths so far, according to ProPublica. Industry giants Tyson Foods, JBS, and Smithfield account for more than half of all positive cases nationally, reports FERN. To health and worker advocates in North Carolina, the state's refusal to release data on outbreaks is suspicious. Ilana Dubester, executive director of Hispanic Liaison in Siler City, who reports that workers at the Mount Air plant say family members are getting sick, says, "I believe they are just protecting the plants." One woman worker at Mount Air had a disabled husband who never left the house. He got the virus first and had to be hospitalized, and then she got it. Since he was housebound, he could only have gotten it from her. The plant receives data from the state, but does not allow testing on site, despite repeated requests by health advocates for permission to set up testing in the parking lot, Dubester says. Hispanic Liaison worked with Piedmont Health and the Gillings School of Public Health at UNC to conduct tests of Mount Air workers and family members off-site. They found an alarming 634 positive cases connected with the plant, according to Dubester. Meatpacking's high risks arise from the frigid air inside plants and crowded workstations on fast-moving lines. Immigrant workers often commute in packed buses and live in crowded households. Punitive sick leave and attendance policies raise risks for community spread. Many plants were slow in providing masks and adopting safety protocols after the spring outbreak, worker advocates say. Due to incomplete test data, health officials often first learn of outbreaks or safety lapses from frightened workers. Unfortunately, recently developed Center for Disease Control and Prevention guidelines for meat processors are weak, filled with suggestions rather than requirements, and allowing asymptomatic workers who test positive to return to work rapidly instead of adopting the widely accepted protocol of a 2-week quarantine. One company that now shares data on cases is Tyson's Wilkesboro plant, where a quarter of the 2,200 workers tested positive in April. But it took the threat of a court order to prompt Tyson to report the data, according to ProPublica, which learned through a public records request that Tyson went silent after hiring a private testing company, leaving health officials confused on how to track infected workers. Nationwide, 22 plants closed temporarily in April, prompting Tyson to place ads in newspapers claiming, quote, the food supply chain is breaking. A day later, President Trump ordered plants to remain open, a move that union leaders say forces workers to choose between a paycheck and their health. New York Times found that even as Tyson and Smithfield lobbied for favors, they were exporting record amounts of pork to China. Governor Roy Cooper's recent executive order addressing racial health disparities is a start to addressing these problems, but a June 16th letter from NC Policy Watch asked the governor to do more to strengthen transparency and safety rules for meatpacking. We risk super spreader events when authorities collude with corporations to hide data on viral spread. Family members and businesses that serve plant workers deserve to be informed of risk. ProPublica learned that during an outbreak at a Tyson plant in Iowa, owners of local businesses that served plant workers or employed their relatives complained to the health department about failing to alert them earlier so they could adopt timely safety measures. This virus crisis has laid bare our dependency on essential minority and immigrant workers, and it is far past time to end the shameful legacy of dumping risk on them. In a pandemic, festering systematic injustices can rapidly evolve into higher risks for everyone. The virus does not discriminate. Leaders who do can no longer claim the public's trust. Now on to Bella Smith's article in Indie Week, News North Carolina, Youth to the Booth. Older folks love work in the polls, but not during COVID-19. The state wants young democracy heroes to save the day. Polling locations don't change much. Plastic fold-out tables, the cups of ballpoint pens, fluorescent overhead lights, and that large printer-looking thing that digests your ballots once you've filled out. And, of course, the senior citizens who merrily staff them. Older folks love working the polls. As of 2018, 6 in 10 election workers were senior citizens, and nearly a third were over 70. Since many of them return year after year, election officials have come to rely on this elder population of helping hands. Given their vulnerability to COVID-19, however, a growing number of older election workers are putting their health first by staying home for the upcoming election, according to Patrick Gannon, the public information officer for the State Board of Elections. The North Carolina State Board of Elections is urging younger, healthier people to pick up the slack. Election officials are seeking democracy heroes who will sign up to work at polling sites for early voting in October or the general election in November. North Carolinians can take the first step in becoming a paid democracy hero by filling out an interest survey sign-up form at ncsbe.gov. ncsbe.gov. Democracy heroes will have the opportunity to learn about the inner workings of elections, the bipartisan teams who run them, the safeguards in place to protect voters against fraud and COVID-19, and more. Gannon says, we're encouraging anyone who wants to learn more about the voting process, learning more about elections, and help their communities at the same time to step up and become a democracy hero You'll learn a lot, and you'll get paid as well. Polling sites have been a nationwide concern during the pandemic. States across the country have struggled to varying degrees with handling their in-person primaries. 16 states, including New York, Kentucky, and West Virginia, chose to delay their primaries or replace them with a vote-by-mail system. Wisconsin, which chose not to delay, was the first state to hold its primaries during the peak of the coronavirus. 7,000 poll workers stepped down, fearing for their safety, which forced Wisconsin election officials to close hundreds of polling sites. Milwaukee typically has 182 polling sites for its almost 600,000 residents. The steep drop in poll workers meant that only 5 polling places were open, which depressed turnout by 37%. These stark results played out in many other states, especially within urban and marginalized populations. Researchers have shown that a decreased number of in-person voting sites disproportionately impacts Black and Indigenous voters, as well as people who have disabilities or require language assistance. As North Carolina gears up for the general election, election officials and state legislatures have increased funding for vote-by-mail and protective measures for in-person voting sites. More accessible absentee voting suggests, Gannon says, there'll be more people who vote by mail this year than ever before. But while absentee voting and early voting will likely be more popular than in past years, in-person election day voting remains ingrained in voter behavior. Gannon says, we know there'll be a lot of people who would rather cast their ballot in person. We have to make polling places and early voting sites safe and accessible for anyone who wants to vote in person. That said, we need election workers to make that happen. North Carolina has about 2,700 polling places on Election Day, as well as early voting sites October 15th through 31st. Since each polling place is staffed by 5 or 6 workers, Gannon estimates that statewide there are more than 15,000 election workers. The State Board of Election is seeking hundreds, if not thousands, of democracy heroes to ensure North Carolina can keep all its polling sites open and accessible. The State Board of Elections is planning outreach efforts to train college students, veterans, and retired veterans and advocacy groups. High school students who turn 17 by Election Day and are U.S. citizens can apply to become a student election assistant. And now our cover article by Lewis Kendall, Battle Line. I'll read as much of this as time permits. Belinda Joyner is tired of fighting the Atlantic Coast Pipeline, but she's still fighting. In February, Belinda Joyner caught a ride to the U.S. Supreme Court. Alongside a couple of close friends, the 67-year-old rode from her home in Gettysburg, a 1,000-person town near the North Carolina-Virginia border, up to Washington, D.C. They were there to watch the court hear arguments over whether the U.S. Forest Service should be allowed to issue permits for the Atlantic Coast Pipeline to be built through National Forest lands connected to the Appalachian Trail. The 600-mile, $8 billion pipeline, spearheaded by Dominion Energy and Duke Energy and first proposed in 2014, would run through West Virginia, and North Carolina, delivering some 1.5 billion cubic feet of natural gas per day from the Appalachian Basin. In North Carolina, the pipeline is set to snake through 8 counties: Halifax, Nash, Wilson, Johnston, Sampson, Cumberland, Robeson, and Northampton. That's Joyner's backyard. This week, the Supreme Court ruled 7-2 to allow the companies to secure right-of-way under the AT. The ruling was a blow to Joyner and her neighbors. The pipeline, they say, is just the latest example of unwanted industry development disrupting their community with dire consequences for human and environmental health. But in the marathon that is the fight for environmental justice, setbacks come with the territory. In the shadow of the nearby second home tourist haven Lake Gaston, Northampton County, with its predominantly black population, has been a hotbed of environmental activism for more than 25 years. But with the ACP halfway in the ground and the nearby Enviva wood pellet facility recently granted permits to expand by the State Department of Environmental Quality, a development that raises additional concerns over air pollution, community members say they've been worn down by the Sisyphean task of fighting for a healthy future. Joyner says the companies don't live here, so they don't have to suffer with the damage they cause to the community. We're tired of being dumped on. Northampton County is at a crossroads. Perched on the border of Virginia and the geological fall line, where the harder rock of the Piedmont region transitions to the softer soils of the coastal plain, the area is bisected by both the CSX rail line, which ships freight from the Deep South to ports in Virginia, and the Roanoke and Meharon rivers. The home of Tuscarora and Meharon Native Americans, the area was later known for its horse racing scene. Driving down the highway, you can spot the historical marker honoring Sir Archie, one of the industry's legendary equine founding fathers. Today, the fields of peanuts and cotton are interspersed with driving ranges and Dollar Generals, but much of the development has felt less auspicious. On a warm, cloudless day, Joyner tours me around her hometown, rubbing her temples as she describes the struggles the community of 20,000 has faced. A retired schoolteacher with an infectious cackle, Joyner was born and raised in Gettysburg. She remembers when the Lowe's Distribution Center opened, bringing with it one of the first pockets of stable jobs, and when the Piggly Wiggly left, leaving the area without a grocery store. Joyner is on a first-name basis with as many state environmental groups as she is with company executives, but her activism grew more from necessity than idealism. Her first foray into environmental justice was in the late 1990s when a fertilizer company decided to build a plant down the street from where she lives. Back then, she says, it was easier to organize and motivate folks. The company sent out a letter notifying residents about the planned plant, and by that afternoon, Joyner had 30 people crammed into her house to voice their concerns to county commissioners. I'm a curious person, Joyner says. I try to pay attention to things and not take it for granted to say it can't happen to me, because if it can happen to you, it can happen to me. Their collective action proved enough to stop the fertilizer plant, and the group stuck together. Over the years, Joyner and her allies fought a number of battles against development they saw as environmentally or physiologically damaging. The West Rock paper mill, the hog farm on Warner Bridge Road, the natural gas compressor station. In 2015, a company called Vista Green purchased an 800-acre piece of land in the northeastern part of the county with plans to build a pair of landfills to dispose of coal ash produced by Duke Energy and Dominion Energy. The landfills, Vista Green promised, would bring jobs and millions in new revenue for the county. Residents concerned over reports of the impact of leaching coal ash wanted nothing to do with the project. Joyner and the others formed Northampton County Citizens Against Coal Ash, attending county commissioner meetings and organizing against the proposed landfills. In 2018, the county planning board denied the company its proposal to rezone the area. Each of these fights made the community more resilient, Joyner says, but also more resigned to industry encroachment. Citizens Against Coal Ash still meets once a month to stay abreast of developments, but the years have turned some residents' collective indignation into self-preservation. To require folks who are struggling to pay the electric bill or find child care to confront an existential threat like climate change or a multinational corporation is asking for division, Joyner says. It just destroys a neighborhood, she says. Now everyone's about self instead of caring about people or your neighborhood or community or where you live. Designated a Tier 1 county by the state, which means the most distressed based on factors including income and unemployment, Northampton's median household income is $36,000 compared to the state's median of 52,000. The county's 57% black, and one in every five residents lives below the poverty line. Last year, the University of Wisconsin calculated a ranking system for all the counties in the United States based on health outcomes, such as lifespan and self-reported health status, and other factors, environmental, social, and economic. According to that report, out of the 100 counties in North Carolina, Northampton ranks 92nd in health factors, 96th in health outcomes. These quality of life struggles are exactly why companies decide to expand in communities like Northampton, says Richie Harding, a member of the County Board of Education. He says, you don't want to have a hog farm in the middle of Raleigh, so you're going to look at rural areas where there's going to be less fight. People get ran in the ground, they get worn out. In a trend echoed nationwide, the area's economic struggles have led to an exodus, with those who can, roughly 11% of the county's population since 2010, leaving for greener pastures. One of Joyner's friends in the environmental justice movement was among those to decide he'd had enough. She says, unless you're going to work in a fast food restaurant, there's not a lot to come back to Northampton County for. Our children go away and only come back for a visit. But for her, attached by a commitment to the community, leaving isn't an option. My daughter asked me one time, Mama, if I win the lottery, where do you want me to build you a house? And I said, I'm going to stay right here. I don't know anywhere else I'd want to live but right here. As we wind through the county back roads, Joyner points out the cuts where the Atlantic Coast Pipeline has been routed. By one count, 6% of the pipeline is already in the ground. The freshly turned ochre-colored soil is the only indication that anything happened here. But a few of the pipes, sea foam green lengths of steel, 3 feet in diameter, are yet to be buried. The companies think it's a done deal, she says. That's why they're pressing so hard to get it going. According to Federal Energy Regulatory Commission analysis, more than half the 105 census tracts in Virginia and North Carolina within a mile of the pipeline's route have disproportionately high populations that are low income or communities of color, including some 30,000 Native Americans. Compared to statewide numbers, the analysis also found that Native Americans are overrepresented by a factor of 10 along the North Carolina section of the pipeline route, according to Ryan Emanuel, an NC State associate professor who wrote a letter in Science about the issue. The ACP reported it would compensate landowners based on fair market value, but according to a review of easement agreements, some were paid as little as $160 an acre for the company to run the pipeline through their land. One landowner at a recent DEQ meeting said, when you're trying to get locals land and you stick a check in their face and say, you either take our money or we'll take you to court, what is that if not taking our land? In Northampton County, Joyner and other residents are concerned about the blast zone of the pipeline, an industry-calculated area within which a hypothetical explosion would cause injury or death. The ACP's blast zone encompasses some of Garysburg and a portion of nearby Roanoke River Wildlife Refuge. They worry, too, about that compressor station down the road and the increased construction traffic kicking up dust and clogging roads. Silverleen Aston, another Garysburg resident, says, we don't need no addition. We're dealing with enough. The pipes themselves, coated with an epoxy, may also pose a safety risk. Manufactured by 3M, the fusion-bonded epoxy is considered a carcinogen, and the National Association of Pipe Coating Manufacturers advises that pipes coated with that epoxy be stored above ground for no longer than 6 months. Some pipes have been sitting exposed to the sun since shortly after they were built in late 2015, according to groups like Clean Water for NC. In response last summer to concerns about the coating and an FERC directive, Dominion downplayed the hazards, writing that, quote, Although 3M has no conclusive evidence at this time to confirm their exact identity, the degradation products are generated in low quantities, have low water solubility, and are therefore not expected to enter the environment in amounts capable of producing an adverse human health effect. The project has faced legal challenges since its inception. Environmental groups have lodged a Title VI complaint against the DEQ, alleging the agency discriminated on the basis of race when it issued certifications for the pipeline. They have also petitioned the state to revoke permits issued in early 2018 that the groups claim were based on faulty math and incorrectly assessed community impacts. And there are now questions regarding the underlying need for the gas the pipeline plans to deliver, with Dominion admitting, backed up by an Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis report, that natural gas consumption will likely remain flat for the next 15 years. The ACP voluntarily halted construction in late 2018 after the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals issued a stay of several federal permits. While that recent Supreme Court decision eliminated one hurdle for the project, it is still missing seven state and federal permits, according to the Southern Environmental Law Center. The Supreme Court's ruling does not disturb other aspects of the Fourth Circuit's decision, which found that the Forest Service has violated the National Forest Management Act and the National Environmental Policy Act in approving the pipeline's route through two national forests. According to one analysis, the company has said it plans to push forward to the project as soon as it's legally able to and filed a recent notice with FERC requesting an extension for construction until late 2022. And in the end, in keeping with North Carolina utilities law, the ACP will recover much of its investment through charges to taxpayers, regardless of the demand for the project or its eventual production. Joyner says, "It's the taxpayers' money. So in other words, I'm paying you to kill me." In Gettysburg, it's impossible to miss the trucks. On the tight two-lane US 158, which parallels the state line, in northeastern North Carolina, the flatbeds rumble along, stacked high, with the trunks of soft pine headed to be pulverized, dried, and compacted into tiny hard pellets, transported north to a port in Virginia, and from there shipped across the Atlantic Ocean to Europe to be burned for heat and fuel. In Gettysburg, the trucks are all headed to the same place, a turnoff marked by a white sign emblazoned with the word Enviva. Founded in 2004, the company's first North Carolina plant, which is built on an old Georgia Pacific sawmill, opened in Ahoskie in 2011. Plans for the Gettysburg facility soon followed. Locals pushed back against the company, voicing concerns to the North Carolina DEQ over air pollution from the dryers, dust from construction, and the constant caravan of log-laden flatbeds. They raise questions, too, about the sustainability and benefits of the biomass industry. But despite the protests, Enviva's Gettysburg plant secured state approval and in 2013 churned out its first load of pellets. Situated near several homes and partially obscured by trees, the biomass facility cranks out hundreds of thousands of tons of pellets each year. At a public hearing last summer to determine if the DEQ should issue permits to allow the facility to increase production by 235,000 tons per year, residents questioned whether the company was properly measuring emissions of carbon dioxide, sulfur dioxide, and volatile organic compounds, or VOCs, in the air. J.C. Woodley, a retired EPA worker from Northampton County, told DEQ officials at a hearing, "People in this community need to know exactly what they're being exposed to. We need to know. We need protection." The agency received some 2,400 public comments, at least 95% of which opposed the expansion. In October, it approved the new permit under the condition the company must install additional air emission control equipment. Emission controls aside, this type of bridge fuel expansion, similar to natural gas, runs counter to the accepted science that calls for drastic and immediate emissions cuts, says Rachel Weber, a former forest and climate campaigner with a nonprofit Dogwood Alliance. We are on a tremendously tight and aggressive timeline to make carbon emission reductions, she says. That's why we need to be making significant, sweeping changes today. Viewed strictly from a forestry health perspective, some argue that wood pellets are a viable form of fuel. Fred Cubbage and Robert Apt, professors at NC State Department of Forestry, say the carbon bottom line is that forests at a regional scale in North Carolina are sustainable. In a recent op-ed in the News and Observer, forest volume and carbon are increasing. Life cycle analysis and dynamic timber markets and investments at the state level support the merits of this renewable resource. In terms of overall emissions, however, the jury is out on biomass. A recent UK report determined that greenhouse gas emissions from biomass could be either higher or lower than traditional fossil fuels, but in neither case will come close to the net zero emissions goal the UK has set for 2050. While the down-the-line greenhouse gases are concerning, the main issue for local residents is emissions from the plant that may be directly affecting their health. The plant emits VOCs, a component of smog that, in elevated quantities, has been tied to negative health impacts, such as nervous system and organ damage. Alston lives a stone's throw from the Enviva plant on land her grandfather inherited. As soon as the facility opened, she says she would wake up to find her home covered in a layer of fine dust. You have no choice but to deal with it because it's there, she says. I can't afford to jump up and leave town. And there's the noise. Heavy machinery operating, sometimes in the middle of the night, which keeps Alston from sleeping. She used to call the company to complain, but it never worked. The noise still goes on. It ain't stopped. But I got tired of calling, she says. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Indie Week. I cannot continue with that article, unfortunately. I'm John Federson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Indie Week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.